Lucky for us, most interactions between us and our pets are fine. But if you are bitten by a cat, there can be some serious medical issues for you. Larry Mueller here. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. She takes time every month to talk with us about how to keep your pet healthy and happy. And she has some great information to share today that can help keep everybody happy and healthy as well. Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
We have just this week, the Mayo Clinic released a new report about cat bites and human health and findings.
Yeah, definitely. You know, this is something that as a veterinarian, we're always concerned about because many cats don't like coming to the vet, and we are often on the receiving end of cat bites. And I can tell you how we deal with them. If anybody gets bit, even if it looks minor, like a teeny tiny puncture wound, most of those wounds end up being on our hands. And that's why this was a report that was published in the Journal of Hand Surgery for, this is actually a human report. We get the person immediately soaking their hand in a chlorhexidine or a betadine soak while we cancel all their appointments for the next couple of hours so they can go to the emergency room and get treated right away. But what this study showed is that on the average, people waited 27 hours before getting help. And that's because these little wounds, unlike dog wounds, which are more crushing, causing physical damage to tissues, these look rather minor and people tend to ignore them. But they're actually injecting bacteria from the mouth down into those areas where we've got tendons and muscles and so on. And when it's in the hand, those are real tight spaces, and a little bit of swelling can result in lots of pain. And what they ended up finding, though, is that of the people that ended up going into the hospital, 30% of those patients were hospitalized immediately. And of those that were sent home with just antibiotics, 14% had to end up going back into the hospital again. That antibiotics alone didn't treat this. And of the 197 people or so that were in this, 193 people, 8 of these people ended up having to have multiple surgeries done. Oh. And so this is a really serious problem for us. And so don't take cat bites lightly. And, you know, when you've got a cat, teach it to play with toys on strings and wands. Don't encourage them that they can bite you. Also make sure that you keep your cat up to date on rabies vaccine, even though they're indoors. And the limited exposure to wildlife, because I've had a couple of cases in my career where strictly indoor cats have been exposed to bats, and it's created a lot of problems. Anytime you go into the hospital with a bite, doctors are responsible for reporting this to animal control so that they can then come to your house and check out the rabies status. And so even though you may be in the hospital, your cat may end up being in quarantine and in the hospital as well, if they're not current on the rabies vaccine. So just make sure you get your cat bite wounds treated immediately and keep your cat up to date on vaccinations.
And even when those situations occur, unfortunately, our former cat Hunter put one of your students in the hospital for 3 days.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And many of these hospital stays are for multiple days. IV antibiotics, surgery, debridement, wound flushing and so on. And the pain of having this done with permanent disfigurement as well. I can remember back several years ago, we had a student who was very interested in becoming a veterinarian and getting into vet school and was working as a receptionist at our vet school part-time and working at a clinic outside the vet school. She ended up getting badly bit to the point where her hand, she had to have multiple surgeries done. She changed careers after that. She could not even think about dealing with cats again because of the trauma and the pain that she went through with this. So it can have life-changing effects. So,
Well, Jenny and Colby has a story to tell, I think. Jenny, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I am the classic case that you are talking about.
Okay.
Our cat bit me, actually attacked me. I don't know what he saw outside that just sent him over the edge. But I happened to be standing beside him, and he turned and latched onto my ankle, tore a hole in it.
Oh.
This was 10:30 at night. I was at the clinic first thing the next morning. And we treated it with oral antibiotics until Monday morning. Sunday night, I noticed that my ankle was starting to swell, my foot. So I was back at the clinic Monday morning and in the hospital that night, and I spent 8 days in the hospital.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Surgery, the whole nine yards.
Oh, boy. And waiting.
Mm-hmm.
The waiting didn't help.
It didn't help. But, you know, she did go in within, it sounds like, about 12 hours or so, like right in the next morning. But, again, it was in one of those extremity-type injuries, and that's usually where we get bit, our lower limbs, our hands, you know, and wrists and so on. And those are the areas that can cause the most severe problems with swelling and the spread of infections down tendon sheaths and so on. But even if it's on a different spot on your body, these wounds really need to be treated with appropriate antibiotics and flushing and soaking and so on. And you were right. 69% of the people that received cat bites in this study were female. So I have no idea whether it's just we've got all these, like, it's, pardon me, I don't mean that you are, but crazy cat ladies out there, you know, who knows? But or maybe it's our nurturing demeanor that, you know, we've got a cat that's upset and we try to go up and calm them down. And so we're on the receiving end of bites. I don't know. I'm sounding very sexist here, aren't I? But yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad you're feeling better, though, and that you did get the help that you needed.
Thanks, Jenny. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Don a chance to join in as well. Don in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call.
Some weeks ago, I was involved in an adoption procedure from a rescue cat organization, and this was a huge white cat that was a little overly aggressive, and I've had cats off and on during most of my life, and I got used to these, as I used to call them, love taps, when cats would sort of touch their teeth on you.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And not really bite you, but just this cat was overly ambitious in this procedure, and I happened to let the adoption agency know that he had bitten and drawn blood a couple of times. It didn't bother me. I just licked it and went on.
Oh. Oh, my goodness. Okay. A little oral human bacteria added to the cat bacteria mix. You know, and I think the fact that I'm just going to put my opinion out there. You called them like love nips or love bites. Cats don't have a really good way of telling us, I've had enough of you touching me, of you cuddling me, of you petting me, or whatever you're doing. And often they'll start with their body language. You may start seeing things like their tail will start to flick a little bit. They may start flattening their ears, not totally against their head, but they may just kind of turn them back. They may turn and look at you. And us being oblivious to all those very strong signals that cats are sending us, wait until the cat turns around and puts his teeth on us. Yes, it's a bite. It's an inhibited bite. But if you were to keep going with what you're doing, then you're going to end up having more, you know, potential for trauma. So I refuse to refer to these as love bites. That is a cat that is trying to control you, stop you, using the only thing they're able to do, either their claws or their teeth. And in many cases, it's their teeth. So drop that word love. You know?
There you go. You know, back to Hunter for a minute. Hunter was a cat that, you know, you had to, we worked with him a lot with toys to keep, try to teach him not to bite or be biting types. But our daughter, Emily, who was pretty small, he would let her do just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
He somehow knew that she was a little thing.
And it's very possible that, you know, just the way she was approaching the cat, you know, the fact that she maybe wasn't as physically threatening as an adult, that maybe leaning over the cat or making him a little more scared. Thank goodness for her that, you know, he was gentle and wonderful. I mean, I know she used to dress him up in clothes and do all kinds of things. So,
Thanks, Don, for calling. Tom in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Yes, we haven't had a problem with this yet, but we have a farm at the edge of town, and we have a lot of cats, and our dog dispatches a lot of these wild cats, and I was just concerned, do I need to worry about?
If your dog gets bit by a cat, yeah, it's going to depend. One, dogs have that added protection of a thicker hair coat than we have. And so often that's going to pad the injury and you may not see, you know, actual puncture wounds. But I would think that if the dog got bit on an area that has tighter skin, like on a distal limb, it's going to be very similar to injuries like we have, where it could result in swelling and pretty severe infection. But a bite wound anywhere can become infected. And that's why when we see even cats that fight with each other, very commonly get cat bite abscesses. And it's because, again, yes, it's the same species, but they're inoculating that cat with those needle-like teeth with bacteria. And so even a cat that comes in with, you know, evidence of puncture wounds and maybe running a little fever, but no evidence of an actual abscess, we will get those cats started on antibiotics and taken care of as soon as we can, hopefully before they actually develop an abscess, which may need surgery and drainage and so on. So it's with your dog, same thing. Keep an eye on them if they're getting in close contact with a cat.
Thanks for calling. Looking at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining in. You can reach us with a phone call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly, actually. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you go to The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you have a photo of your pet, we'd love to see that too. You put that up. Chris in Madison, hi.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay. I have a disabled kitty.
Okay.
And he has vision problems, among other things. And I was feeding him some hot dogs as a treat. And he got a hold of my finger because he thought that it was one of the hot dogs.
I shouldn't laugh. Yeah.
No, I mean it sounds amusing, but my finger swelled up and got all purple. And we had gotten 14 inches of snow and we're in a blizzard that day. And I thought that I was going to have to call an ambulance to take me to the hospital because my cat ate a hot dog out of my hand. So. People just need to be a little, I mean, we don't need people taking their cats to the Humane Society and having them euthanized because they're afraid that they're going to be, you know, getting into a problem.
No.
People just need to be careful.
Yeah, and it's comes down so much to understanding cat behavior and recognizing body language signals, you know, starting out with, you know, if you get a kitten, you know, gentle early handling and socialization. Those are all such important things to prevent problems down the road. And, you know, I have two cats at home myself, and both of them have a little bit different personalities. And I know one who's absolutely a love bug. As soon as I start doing anything like medically related to him, oh my goodness. I mean, he turns into your worst nightmare. And so I realized that, you know, for that cat, I have to take him in and have the professionals, you know, the professional handling people, our technical staff, and I have to buy them lunch usually when I bring them into work, help me with handling my own cat. So it's understanding your cat and understanding what they can do. And then if the worst happens, seek medical help right away.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for listening in. Appreciate your calls at 800-642-1234 and your photos and emails and questions. Also, go put those photos up on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You have a new doggy.
I do. And I, after the last show, I was going on vacation and we waited until we came back from vacation to adopt our new boy. He's a 7.5-year-old retired bulldog who is He's huge and muscular. He's about 70 pounds. And he is the love of my life. Sorry, Mark. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. We've had him for less than 3 weeks, and he's already just welcomed himself into our home, gets along well with our other dog. His name is Gentleman Jim Dandy. But our problem was the former owner called him Danders or Dandy. And that sounds kind of like Vanny or Vanna, our dog, that the other dog that I have. And so we were like, well, what are we going to call him? We can call him Dan. And that's, we have a friend named Dan. Do we call him Jim or JD? But we have a friend named JD and his name's Jim. So Mark just decided he's going to start calling him Bruce. And he's answering to that. After a couple of weeks, he's just like, okay, you're going to call me Bruce. And I get fed? No problem. But what's really weird when you adopt a new dog is you find out all their little quirks. And because of where he lived in his former life, he was a show dog, he will only walk to the left. When we go out, I cannot go clockwise around the block. So he's kind of like a NASCAR driver, left, left. And so we have to, when we go for a walk, make these kind of, always make sure that we walk in a circle that will get us back home again without having to turn right. Hopefully, once the weather's a little bit better, we'll be able to do some food training and get him to realize that you can turn to the right and no one's going to get mad at you. So just little quirks, but we're dealing with them.
Or as Judith says, are people walking with her? She has a deaf ear, so she has to be outside all the time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have we get mail from time to time, and I got a nice card, a letter.
Yeah, a letter. And it's kind of sad, to be honest with you. This actually came the day I was doing my last show, so it's been sitting here unopened for the last month. And this is from a woman named Dorothy, who lives in St. Germain, Wisconsin. And unfortunately, Dorothy lost her beloved Bichon at 13 and a half to a type of cancer called hemangiosarcoma. And I've lost a pet to hemangiosarcoma as well. And it's, just even yesterday, I had one of my colleagues, but she's a large animal veterinarian, adopted a new dog that is a three-year-old German Shepherd. And she's like, I just don't want her to die of cancer. How can I prevent this? And, I'm like, well, if your dog lives long enough, many dogs, this is what's going to happen is it's just cellular damage. And her questions here were, what did I miss? What could I have done? Is it genetic? And I'd have to say it could be environmental. It could be genetic. It may just be luck of the draw with as dogs age, those cells are going to start to mutate and potentially have problems. Hemangiosarcoma is one of those interesting cancers, though, that we usually get in right when the dog has just started to show symptoms, and it's usually too late. It's a cancer of the blood vessels. And so you can imagine how fragile these are and how fast they can spread around the body. My own dog had a lump on his chest wall that I did a needle aspirate of, and thinking that it was probably just going to be fat, but it came back as blood. And I'm like, why am I getting all this blood? And lo and behold, it was hemangiosarcoma. And this was a small little mass on his chest wall. And this is a basset hound that I had several years ago. And we did chest x-rays. It was already in his lungs. We looked in his abdomen. It was already in his spleen and liver. It had really spread everywhere. And even though I went through chemotherapy and so on, and he had a wonderful time having it done. He never felt sick. It did give us a few more months to be able to come to terms with this, but typically the way many dogs present with this type of cancer is dead on arrival. They have this tumor in their body, and all of a sudden those fragile blood vessels rupture, they have a bleed, and you find them dead on the kitchen floor outside. If there's a way to go, oh my goodness, no suffering. These dogs typically show no symptoms at all. So Dorothy, don't beat yourself up. You didn't miss anything. It's just one of those things. It's a type of cancer that even if you were to have caught it early, their life expectancy would have been rather short. It's usually already spread by the time you've diagnosed it. So, I'm so sorry that you've had a month of sitting here waiting for answers, but your dog is now at rest and at peace and probably did not have one moment of suffering.
There we go. And thank you very much for sending the note. We really appreciate it. And, we welcome other letters and notes as well. Marina in Fox Lake, Illinois, has on the phone here with a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Marina.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to find out, I volunteer for some animal shelters and things like that, and wanted to know, I work primarily with dogs, why the cat bites are significantly worse than dog bites or ferret bites or any other mammal you might have around the house.
I think a couple of reasons. One, their teeth are like needles, and so they're and most of the wounds that we get are usually on the hands or ankles, which you can then run into the compartment syndrome or compartmentalization syndrome. I'm not sure what the human term is, where you get a little bit of swelling, the tissue can't spread or stretch, and so it ends up causing more troubles. Cats have a bacteria-rich mouth, and I think part of the reason why they become more problematic than other wounds is that when we look at it, it looks like a small puncture wound, like you'd maybe, you know, had a thumbtack or something, you know, you've pricked your finger on the end of a thumbtack. And so we don't do anything about it. And then it turns into something major. Dog bite wounds, although they can get infected, typically are more deep tissue damage, bruising, and so on. And we don't see as many dog bite wounds get infected as cat bite wounds. So ferrets, I can't tell you the statistics on ferrets. I used to have them. I've never been bit with by a ferret. I had some as pets, and in my past used to manage them medically. But I really would have to look that up about ferrets. I don't know why ferret wounds are not as reported. Maybe it's because they're not as popular as cats as pets.
Yeah, we just don't see enough of them. Yeah, thanks, Martha, for calling. Appreciate it. And just to kind of go along with this, Anne emailed and wondered if cat scratches are as dangerous as the bites.
Our local animal control agency actually looks at cat bites and cat scratches in the same light. If your cat were to scratch somebody, it was a deep scratch, you went in to seek medical attention, you need to show proof of rabies. So it comes down to liability issues. Cat scratches, there are different bacteria and things that can cause problems for people. There's actually a disease called cat scratch disease or cat scratch fever, and it's a bacteria that cats may be having on their claws that will end up getting embedded and cause pretty chronic severe illness in people. I think the cat scratches tend to, you know, they can get infected, but it's not as severe as cat bites. It's more the cosmetic issues, kind of like dog bites. Cat scratches kind of fall in that same line.
August sent a Facebook comment who, has a different story. He was the kitty bath assistant. By the time we finished all nine cats, arms were fully full of bites and scratches.
Oh, my goodness.
I just wrote it off as them boosting my immune system and never had a problem.
And, you know, if it wasn't on his hands and it was his upper arms, maybe a different story. And, you know, just because the skin's a little more stretchy up there, there's less tendons and so on for that bacteria to start traversing and causing more troubles. But I think he needs to go to Vegas. Yeah.
Joan in Williams Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I'm allergic to this freezing weather, so I've been in the house for about, maybe this is the third day, and I know there's going to be more days, but my dog, I got a little 8-pound tiny toy poodle, and his behavior, I don't know if he's just so attached to me now. He follows me wherever I am, doesn't let me out of his sight, and I want to be, you know, going about my own business. I'm wondering if this would bother the dog to be in all the time. I do have a large condo, so he's got space to move around in it, but he just stays close to me.
Yeah, you know, and we're seeing this with this kind of weather we've been having all winter very commonly, that we've got dogs that are bored, that are used to being able to go outside and run around in the backyard. With the deeper snow and the just bitterly cold weather, many dogs are staying inside. And so it's up to us as pet parents to try to come up with the things that we can do to keep them mentally stimulated, whether it be playing like hide and seek with food and food treats, getting food dispensing toys, playing fetch games in the house. We really have to sometimes rack our brain to come up with things that will keep our dogs occupied, especially if walking outside or, you know, being outside is their main form of entertainment. I am also seeing a number of pets that are having elimination problems because they don't want to go outside when it's cold like this. Even like my own dog twice has just walked over to her dog bed when it's been like 30 below and just said, you know, I'm not going through that dog door to go outside. Even though we shoveled the snow and made it a nice clean area for her, she just squatted on her dog bed and went. Normal urine. And so I had it checked out to make sure that she doesn't have any medical problems. It was strictly behavioral that, hey, this is nice and absorbent, and why should I go outside when I've got this thing to be able to go on? That's probably been our biggest problem. So this will pass soon. Hopefully spring will be here. You know, welcome to Wisconsin.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Joan. Bernie in Valders. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a what was a Texas game farm dog from a rescue group. I'm fostering him, and well, he hates the weather here terribly. He won't go out with the other dogs unless I kind of make him go. But it is he seems to be quite healthy now. When I got him about 2 months ago, he was borderline emaciated. He's filled out nicely, looks healthy, except for a couple of his teeth kind of look enlarged and slightly tumorous, but I'm assuming that the vet from the rescue group checked him out, and that's okay. But the one problem that he's having is every once in a while he will just open his mouth real wide and gag. I will periodically find yellow splats of fairly significant amounts of like bile, with little bits of food on the floor, and you know, in trying to find a home for him, this can be an issue.
Yeah. So what do we do here?
Yeah, you know, anytime we have a dog that's vomiting like this, it needs to be checked out. This has been one of the big concerns that we've had with many of the adoptive dogs that we're getting are coming up from shelters and so on in the southern area where there aren't as many people willing to adopt them. And we're seeing more parasitic diseases, hookworm, heartworm disease, you know, other external parasites. And so the first thing I would do is, even though this dog may have been checked out by the rescue group, you know, unless you've got a detailed evaluation with the write-up from the veterinarian, this may be something that, you know, was never brought up. And so did they do a stool check? Did they, you know, look for parasites like maybe there's one that lives in the stomach called Physaloptera that can cause chronic vomiting? You know, does he have some other underlying health problems like liver disease or a gallbladder problem or something that could be making him do this? So I think getting him in, getting some lab work done, and I know this is all going to be based on what the rescue group has money to do, but it really needs to be looked into so that you're not adopting a dog out that has chronic illness to other people. And the business with his mouth, and you said he's got a couple of enlarged areas in his mouth that look like tumors, that has me very concerned. We do see oral cancer in dogs, and this is Dental Health Awareness Month, and it's not just the hygiene of the teeth that we worry about, but anytime when we're doing an oral exam, we're always looking for abnormalities on the tongue, gum tissue, tonsils, any place that are there that potentially may need to be biopsied or looked at. So this, I doubt that the two are related, the vomiting with his mouth, but that mouth needs to be addressed as well. He could have tooth root abscesses. He may have just a benign process going on that's causing gingival or gum enlargement, or he may even have a malignant tumor that's causing some trouble. So, and this can only be assessed usually with a dog under anesthesia, getting some x-rays done of those areas in the mouth, deep probing in the under the gum tissue, and maybe getting a biopsy, or for sure getting a biopsy to determine what's going on to cause that tissue to be enlarged like that. So back to a veterinarian again to get a little more workup done before he gets placed out into the real world.
And as you say, this is Dental Health Month?
It is Dental Health Awareness Month for pets. And, you know, I think so many people are definitely afraid of dentistry, not only because of the fact that they have to undergo anesthesia, but sometimes it's the expense. But my philosophy is do it right or don't do it at all. Well, I don't want to say don't do it at all, but it really, to do dentistry right, it is a procedure that does cost a lot of money. But once you get that mouth cleaned up, I can't tell you how often I see people say, wow, my cat or my dog, they're like a new animal. I didn't even realize that they were having oral pain. Remember, pets will continue to eat up to the end. We rarely see them stopping eating. And so if you're basing, my dog doesn't have dental pain because he's still eating everything, they find ways of manipulating that food in their mouth to allow it to go down to be able to survive, but they're probably living with some discomfort. So, I wish it was every month was dental, you know, awareness month, but they have designated February for that. So get your pet in. If your veterinarian thinks that the pet's mouth needs to be addressed, really consider having it done. And once the pet's mouth is cleaned up, there's lots of things that can be done to prevent your pet from having future health issues with the mouth, whether it be diets, brushing, special treats, you know, rinses. There's all kinds of things that can be used. There's a wonderful website, the Veterinary Oral Health Council, VOHC.org, has a bunch of things listed there that they've evaluated all the research on it and can tell you what works and what doesn't when it comes to oral hygiene.
So it's VOHC.org.
Yep.
Okay. Jim and Camp Douglas, we turn to you next. Hello.
Yes, thank you very much. Say, I had an experience with my five-month-old yellow lab on Sunday that I thought I would share that might help somebody in the event it happens to them. We were out on a walk, and he got a hold of my wife's knit glove. And we could not retrieve the glove, and he swallowed it.
Ooh.
So I ended up calling several veterinarians, and I was told that he probably would pass it, keep my eye on him. One vet wanted to induce vomiting, and I kind of steered away from that and got some Laxatone from one of the vets, started putting that in his food, and I thought if today nothing happened in the passing capacity, I was going to have to take him in and get an x-ray or something. I went to his cage this morning, and he had thrown the glove up from
okay.
his stomach.
Yep.
And that was very much to relieve us of, you know, what potentially could have happened with the small intestine being a little bit trickier
right.
during the digestive process.
Yeah, so yeah.
I thought I would share that with you, and because I know especially these labs like to chew and bite on things, and if somebody else was to go through this, I know it is a little bit traumatic because you're always thinking the worst thing's going to happen, but
yep.
fortunately it was not.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's really difficult to decide how do you want to deal with these things because it's obviously the glove went down fairly easy. But if it got through the stomach into the small intestinal tract, I mean, I've seen dogs pass amazing things, but that's a bulky enough item that it could have caused an obstruction. And now you're looking at surgery and so on. And sometimes it can be life threatening. But then the question is, should we be making dogs try to vomit up something that may be in the stomach? And you really have to know what the item is, because if it's something irritating, you know, trying to have them vomit that up again could potentially be a problem. Sometimes we resort to anesthesia and going in with a scope and a little grabbers and pulling things out and bringing it up to help the dog if we're concerned about it. You're very lucky. I'm glad your dog was able to pass it. And now your wife has hopefully a matched set of gloves. I don't know if being in the stomach has changed it much, but there you go.
Putting it in the washing machine, that's for sure.
I know, yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
No, but the dog isn't.
So. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Oh, man. Well, we have lots of Facebook questions, comments. Midge emailed us. Talking about her ragdoll cat, bitter, very unexpected for this particular cat. Someone suggested the cat might need to see a vet. She took the cat in, and he was in the beginning stages of renal failure.
Yeah, you know, if any time you have a change in your pet's behavior, that is something that would warrant getting them in and having them looked at. You were talking to me before the show. Sorry, I'm going to be divulging client confidentiality stuff here.
That's
but
right.
That one of your cats, it sounds very disgusting, but jumped up on the table where there was a bowl of popcorn and urinated in it. right? Mm-hmm. Yesterday?
It was in a popcorn bowl. No popcorn in it.
Okay, sorry, just the bowl. And then did the same thing in the sink. There, you know, and this tells me that he's telling you, I've got something wrong with my bladder. And so I know that you're going to be setting an appointment either later this afternoon or maybe tomorrow morning for me to get him in and get some urine checked and have a look. You know, and so, you know, in this case, yeah, ragdoll cats tend to be rather laid back, easygoing cats. And to have him all of a sudden bite, does he have something painful? Is he nauseated, uncomfortable? You did the right thing. Get that cat in and have them looked at.
Facebook question from Nancy. Her 55-pound border collie ate about a pound of toffee. I didn't notice for several hours. He's fine now, but what do you suggest if it would happen again? He was moping around then when I discovered the empty candy bar.
Oh, you know, it all depends on what the item is that the dog eats. I mean, if it was something like a pound box of chocolate, different story. I mean, that could be very toxic for your dog. Remember, there's kind of the rule of thumb is an ounce of milk chocolate per pound of body weight is considered potentially lethal. I always recommend people get that Chalk Talks app for their that's free for your smartphone if you want to get that. But the big thing with toffee would probably be the butter content and the sugar content, and the fact that a pound of something going through the intestinal tract is going to make them feel uncomfortable as well. What I would be more concerned about was things like the dog developing severe diarrhea, running into troubles with pancreatitis because of all the grease and the fat that's in toffee. That would be something to be concerned about. So, you know, just a good indication that if you've got pets, you really have to pet-proof your house, and that means keeping things off the counter if your dog's a counter surfer.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Lots of callers online, so I think we'll go right to the phones and Barbara in Gotham. Barbara, hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Larry. I'm happy to talk to you guys. I love pets. I've done them all my life. I currently have a puppy. She's not a puppy. She's 10. Mm-hmm. So okay. I took her to the vet for her nail cutting job, and they showed me how to do it. But in the process, the vet, he cut one of her nails till it bled a little bit. And they stopped it with some kind of device they had there. But that was almost a week ago, and she started acting strange a couple days ago, sort of like favoring that leg.
Mm-hmm.
And this morning I let her out, and she was afraid to jump off the porch.
Oh, my goodness.
And yeah. I was like, well, go, you got to go. All night she's been holding it, you know. So she finally jumped down, and I didn't notice her limping in the snow, but I'm worried that might have got an infection, could it?
Yeah, it definitely could. You know, trimming pets' nails is, I'm going to just back up here a little bit. A couple of years ago, I got asked by the School of Engineering here on campus to help with a design project with first-year engineering students. They wanted to come up with a foolproof nail trimmer. And I know anybody that's trimmed dog nails, groomers, veterinarians, veterinary technicians, pet owners are thinking, no way. You can't do a foolproof. There isn't anything out there. And yet these engineers students were gung-ho at finding something that they would never be able to. You'd never be able to cut a nail too short. Well, that blood vessel and the artery, vein, and nerve that run down the center of that nail, it can really vary in length. And if you've got a dog with pigmented nails, black or brown nails, you can't see where that blood vessel is. And especially if the nails have been allowed to get overgrown, it can be quite long. We call them a long quick. Trimming them is an art. It's a matter of often shaving little bits off and looking at the bottom of the nail until you get to a point where you can start recognizing that you're getting close to that area where the quick is. But sometimes dogs do not tolerate being held still for that period of time, and we may have to just kind of take a guesstimate and, you know, take a piece off, and it's whoops, and it happens to me frequently. It's one of those kind of everyday events. We rarely see them get infected, but it's possible that It could, because now you've got it opened up to that sensitive tissue. And especially in the winter with salt and things being on the road, it could be irritating. So I'd recommend giving your veterinarian a call and just saying, hey, my dog's limping. You know, could that be a problem? And, you know, especially if the toe is swollen or the nail is uncomfortable if you were to touch it, those would be signs that it needs to be looked at. So back to calling your veterinarian again to have that evaluated.
There you go. Thanks, Barb. Jim and Sean, all hello.
Yes, this is Jim.
Yes, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. We have a cat that we adopted from the Shawano Humane Society when she was 8 weeks old. In July, she'll be 5 years old. We thought at first that she was Siamese, but she turned out to be Tonkinese, half Burmese and half Siamese.
Wow.
She's very small. She weighs only 7 pounds. She'll be 5 years old in July. We feed her a treat called Pounce once a day, and she knows exactly. She can tell time. She knows exactly when she wants it. And our vet was commenting on how clean her teeth are just from feeding her that cat treat. She's... We take her to the vet regularly. She has the shots. But certain times of the day, she likes to get playful and bite. So I learned from someone, if she does that, snap her on the nose with your fingers.
I'd have to disagree with that. I'm not sure who gave you that that advice, but typically... If we have a cat that has issues with what we call play aggression, where they're pouncing and stalking you and maybe, you know, hiding under the sofa and rushing out at your ankles and then taking off again, they're usually silent attacks. And it's, you know, it's because cats are predators and they like to go after things that are moving. Typically, the way we handle those cases is make sure that you're playing with your cat appropriately, using toys on strings and wands, things that move. You know, whether it's, you know, some of the electronic toys that they have for cats now, they have like a laser pointer that you can put in the middle of the room called the Bada Beam. There's all kinds of things that are out there that move and keep the cat occupied. That's what we want to do, is redirect the cat to something like that. When you punish the cat by flicking them in the nose or hitting them, what that can create is a cat then that becomes defensive and may be coming after you out of defense. During this time of the day when I'm hiding under the couch and Dad walks by and I try to, you know, interact with him, I get hurt. And so it may just up what she's doing to, instead of just maybe pouncing on you, now I'm going to be pouncing and biting. So redirect her. Do not hit her. Don't flick her in the nose. That can just make things much, much worse.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling, Jim. I want to give Dick in Oak Creek a chance to join us. Dick, hello.
Hi there. Now, we've had cats for 44 years. We're on cats number 5 and 6 right now. I'm curious about one thing, though. Do you think cats have a sense of time? And I'll tell you where I'm going with this. If we're going to go somewhere, say, on a Saturday and go overnight somewhere, leave it. Normally, feeding time is like 5 o'clock in the afternoon for their wet food. And does it really make a difference? What I've been doing is maybe if I know we're going to go away on Saturday, I'll feed them at 5 o'clock on Thursday, maybe 3 o'clock on Friday, and then noon before we go. And I'm wondering if that really makes a difference to them.
It may. Some cats are such creatures of habit that it potentially could cause some problems. You know, where I see more of these feeding problems is the cat waking up in the morning and the owner gets up and feeds the cat. So the cat learns, okay, you feed me at 7, let's wake you up at 6, let's wake you up at 5. And now you've got a cat that's all night long bugging you to eat. And so sometimes changing feeding schedules like that can be more problematic for the cat. But what I would be recommending is you may want to just consider getting one of those automated feeders. They have them that can hold a cold pack that you can put the canned food in, and at 5 o'clock, boop, the door opens and the cat gets its canned food. That way you don't have to be planning ahead and making all this change in time. But, it probably doesn't make any difference that one day you feed at 5 and the next day you feed at noon. But if you want to try to keep the schedule, just, you know, get one of those automatic feeders or have a neighbor come over and do it for you.
Yep. There you go. Automatic feeders. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of different ones out there that either dispense dry food and they measure the volume and will dispense it on with a timer. There's others that have little doors that rotate that maybe hold, you know, 2 or 3 meals that you can put an ice pack in that helps keep it cool if you're using canned food. So lots of cool things that way. And even, you know, devices now that register the cat's microchip or the cat's little magnet that they're wearing on their collar. So that, you know, only that cat can get in to be able to get the food. So all these advances out there just to keep our pets happy.
Ruth in Rhinelander, hello.
Hi. Excuse me. I have a question about, I wanted to know if Sandy can tell me anything about a feral dog.
Not really. It's one of those, I'm sorry I'm being blunt, but one of those rarer dog breeds that we just don't see every day walking into our practice. What I tell my students whenever we get a breed in that they may not recognize is do your homework ahead of time. We'll go online. We'll look at what pictures of the dog so we can recognize them. We'll go to the AKC website or, you know, the website that is, you know, the breed specific websites and start looking at health issues and, you know, maybe conformation problems and behavior issues that a particular pet may have so that we're a little better armed walking into the exam room. I've been looking at this computer screen for the last 10 minutes and going, do I have time to pull out my iPad to start looking up, you know, what this, you know, Faro dog is? I would be able to pick one out in a lineup. But to tell you about their health issues and so on, I really can't, or behavior issues, just because I haven't had enough experience with them. So work with somebody, whether it's a breeder or, you know, going to dog shows, spending some time investigating is going to be your best bet to be able to make sure that you're well educated before you bring in a breed to your life that, you know, and I'm just the thing I'm worried about. It's a very short haired dog and living in Rhinelander, you have to probably get some jackets and booties for the little, they're the big thing because they are a fairly large breed dog.
Yeah.
Well, I saw it in a animal catalog and, it was just the most beautiful animal I ever saw. And I thought, wow, I wonder where that came from.
Yeah.
These were probably over in Egypt for a long time or something. Then
right.
They came over here.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe that they're a sight hound, meaning that they hunt by sight, very similar to things like greyhounds and salukis and breeds like that. So very long-legged, active running dogs and may not be suitable for, you know, a family that, like mine, that likes to lay in the couch at night and have a dog just cuddle up next to you.
There you go. Thanks, Ruth. Thank you for calling. Pat in Suamico, your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just wondered what the doctor thinks about possibly having a cat's teeth filed. We have a cat that likes to nip, and you never know when it's going to come.
Yeah, yeah. I really can't agree to do something like that. The teeth have an artery and a vein and a nerve that run up the center of them. And if you are going to start, you know, taking like the crown, doing a crown amputation on some of these teeth, you probably are going to need to end up having a root canal done. Remember, those canine teeth, what you see of the tooth is the tip of the iceberg. About 2/3 of the tooth sits in the bone below. And if you are going to be extracting those canine teeth for a behavior reason, you're going to be weakening the jaw. There's that potential for jaw fracture. So, it would not be something that I think an ethical vet would be recommending and doing, unless there was a medical reason for it. For the behavior problems, I'd be saying carry a toy with you all the time. Be aware of what your cat is doing. Learn how to read cat body language so that if you see your cat sitting up on the kitchen counter flicking its tail, that's the time you back out of the room and you don't address the cat because it's already showing that it's upset.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Evelyn in Racine, hi to you.
Yeah, good morning. I have a almost 9-year-old male German Shepherd.
Yep.
Who, since he was 2 years old, he develops something called infundibular keratinizing acanthomas, if I'm saying it right. These are lesions.
Skin lesions,
okay.
Yeah, that we've had treated surgically for the past years. This is getting to be extremely expensive. I'm just wondering if we are doing the right thing, or is there another way to do it, or,
Is he getting these big cheesy-filled cysts under his skin? Is that what's happening? Yeah.
Right.
And we do see this being kind of a genetic problem, and for the most part, if they're there and they're not bothering the dog, we don't do anything about them. But if they do rupture and get infected, then we're looking at surgically removing the cyst wall and having them taken care of. It unfortunately, because it can be a genetic predisposition, you're kind of stuck with dealing with this. And there really isn't any other way of doing anything except surgically removing them when the time comes when it has to be done, such as, you know, one that's ruptured and is not healing. There's really nothing medically that can be done. So, oh boy, that's tough. Tough situation to be in. But I'm 9 years old. You've got a dog for a few more years with you. So start saving up your money for those other surgeries.
Oh, man. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. By the way, someone wondered if kittens and puppies have baby teeth.
Yes, they have. They go through two sets of teeth, just like humans do, they usually start falling out when they're about 16 weeks of age, and usually by the time they're 5.5, 6 months of age, sometimes 7, depending on the breed, they've got all of their teeth in, and sometimes those baby teeth don't fall out, and we have to do it for them.
Oh!
Yep. They stay in, and then we've got a crowded mouth and increased risk of periodontal disease and all kinds of problems.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, she is a professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, comes by once a month to talk with us about your pet's health, and she's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can call us at 800-642-1234, and we will be back with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk right after this look at the news. Please do stay with us. Well, if you're a pet owner, I'm sure you want to do whatever you can to keep your pet happy and healthy. And there are a lot of sources of information out there. Kind of hard once in a while to know where to find the most accurate and trustworthy information. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Once a month, we have the chance to visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And she does a great job of staying on top of new developments, sharing them with us in ways that we can, you know, easily use them and understand them. And she's certainly ready to answer your questions. When you phone us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And I haven't looked. I've got to look here, Sandy, and see if we've got some pet photos. I'll take a look and see. I haven't done that yet, so we'll find out. In the meantime, Mary in Schofield has a question for you. Mary, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a 4-year-old Australian Shepherd, healthy, happy dog, wonderful addition to our family. But within the last maybe couple of months, he is favoring his back right paw, holding it up. When he walks around and stuff. And not all the time, just sometimes. We go to the dog park. He has no problems there. It seems like when he lays down, can a paw fall asleep and he gets up and then he's lifting that leg up.
Yeah, and does he warm out of it eventually?
He's
holding it and walking on three legs?
Yep.
Or okay.
Walking around, yeah. An hour later, he'll get up and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, a couple of things come to mind. When we have dogs that are, you know, exercise fine, don't show any troubles, but you know, are stiff and sore when they're getting up from a nap on one or more limbs. You know, we start worrying, do we have some underlying arthritis or something like that going on? But he's a young dog, and unless he's got some other, like, orthopedic disease, like some hip dysplasia or some knee issues or something that are chronic, I just wouldn't, it's kind of odd to have a four-year-old dog be displaying these kind of symptoms. There is an orthopedic problem, though, that can kind of come and go, that can result in the dog being totally normal most of the time, but every once in a while they'll just hold their leg up, kind of hop on three legs, and then it pops back and everything's normal. And it's called a luxating patella, or a loose kneecap, where it slides out, and it may be the position he's sleeping in, that kneecap may be sliding out, and then when he gets up, he has a hard time straightening his leg up until he gets, you know, a little more mobile, and then boop, it pops back in and he's back to being himself again. That would be probably the first thing I would be looking into. And it's a matter of either, you know, just doing thorough palpation or feeling that joint. And that would be something that your veterinarian may be able to manipulate the joint to see if that kneecap is loose. Sometimes you can look at x-rays to see, do we have changes there that may be consistent with that. So bring this up with your veterinarian. And even though it is an intermittent thing, the earlier you get this under control, you may be able to help prevent chronic joint changes if he is going to be prone to developing some arthritis. So get that looked into.
Yep.
Okay.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. And Mike in Cato, Wisconsin. Hello to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Question about aging a dog generally, and specifically a pit bull that we just got from the Humane Society. We were told it was 4 years old, but he's got an awful lot of cute gray on his nose. I was just curious if there's a surefire way to tell how old a dog is.
Oh, I wish there was. I wish every dog came with a birth certificate, because I get this question all the time. You know, when they're young puppies, you can look at, I've already brought up the fact that they lose their baby teeth, and we can sometimes start getting an idea of how old the puppy is by what teeth have fallen out and what new teeth are coming in. But once we've got all those permanent teeth in, then, you know, you have to start looking at other things. And sometimes, you know, the things that I would be looking at, and this is going to create a bunch of gray zone. I don't know how the shelter came up with 4 years old. Sometimes that's just pulled out of the air. But we would look
that's
at things.
Like.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And
that's
it's,
what it felt like.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of the air.
This may sound a little funny, but for intact male dogs, they age, their scrotum gets a little saggier. And so rather than, you know, having a tighter scrotum like a younger dog, these older male dogs will sometimes, you know, they just hang a little bit lower. This is a little embarrassing to talk about, but we also look at their eyes. There's an age-related condition that dogs get. Almost all dogs develop it at some point, and it's called nuclear sclerosis, which is the lens becoming a little more dense, where you can still, the dog can see fine, we can look into the eyes and see the back of the retina and the blood vessels, but that lens, instead of being crystal clear, just has this whitish haze, and that's usually when dogs are approaching senior citizenhood. And then, of course, you know, other things looking at the teeth would be, you know, do we have a lot of tartar buildup? And, you know, things that would be associated with older age. But, you know, even that, I've seen dogs that are 2 years old that have significant tartar, depending on the diet they're on and what they've been chewing on. So even that isn't, you know, something that we can do. So to be honest with you, it's a guess, and it comes down to just watching for symptoms of age. And there's many times where we make a change as the dog gets older. All of a sudden, it's like, this dog wasn't probably two when you got it. He was probably closer to five or six, because look at what's going on with him right now. So enjoy your puppy, or, well, it's not a puppy, but your adult dog for many years to come, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Me as well. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ray and Rhinelander, let's see if I can get you on here. Hi, Ray. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, welcome from 24 below zero in the evening.
Ooh.
Yeah. What? Anyways, I have a 16-year-old cat that passed away on just this Sunday.
Oh.
He had overactive thyroid. We had to force feed and assist him. And, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to go through that again. And I loved him. I wanted to help him. We were trying to, you know, get liquids in him and things, and it's just to no avail. And he ended up, in the end, vomiting and eliminating all his urine, and it was horrible.
Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, you know, force feeding a cat is very, very difficult. And when I hear force feeding, I'm thinking of an owner trying to get, like, opening the cat's mouth, syringing food in. We rarely can give a cat nutritional support through force. If we have a cat that is ill enough that requires assisted feeding, we're usually looking at putting in some type of a feeding tube. And for some conditions, you know, even though it sounds extreme, putting in a feeding tube, it may just be a temporary thing, a bridge to get this cat over the illness and maybe be managed, because hyperthyroid cats can be managed with medication. I'm just wondering if your cat had some other underlying disease going on as well to create a cat that was so ill, such as associated kidney disease or cancer or something else that may have been going along with being hyperthyroid. The reason why I'm thinking that is most cats that develop a thyroid nodule are just ravenous appetite, and they would eat anything you put in front of them and still continue to lose weight. That's kind of the classic textbook hyperthyroid cat. So I'm just wondering, maybe something else was going on, but I agree with you. If you said, you know, I don't want to have a stomach tube put in, trying to, you know, feed a cat and having their last days be miserable with you, you know, forcing food down their throat and them fighting you, it's just no way to have their last days be. So I'm so sorry that you lost your cat and to a treatable disease if that's all they had.
Mm, yeah. Thanks for calling, Ray. Appreciate your call. We have a photo here. Actually, Bernie had called earlier and He has a picture of his dog, and the dog's teats were enlarged, not teeth.
Okay.
And we were looking at teeth.
Yeah,
thinking teeth. And you can see a photo, and I think we see...
Yeah, he's got a couple of nipples that are a little bit bigger there. Sometimes dogs, male dogs, will develop some nipple enlargement, especially if they have a testicular tumor or something. I don't know with the way this dog is laying, because his leg is covering up his back end, whether he's neutered or not. But sometimes, you know, testicular tumors can cause nipple enlargement. Sometimes just chronic trauma. If you've got a nipple in an area that a harness is rubbing or the dog is scratching at it, that can cause the tissue to enlarge as well. So, and we do see breast cancer in male dogs. It's not very common, but we can also see problems with tumors affecting the breast tissue as well. So this would be something that your local veterinarian, rather than the vet down south that did the evaluation initially, should probably be looking into.
Thanks again for sending that photo. And we have another cute photo here of an adopted feral cat. All four paws have six toes.
You know, and I, even though they've got this as a feral cat, no feral cat in their right mind would be sitting there allowing their picture to be taken. they're like a wild animal. My guess is that this is a domestic cat that was maybe just one of those ones that got out and got lost and got picked up and is now found a very loving home that obviously allows them up on tables and counters, which is great because cats like to be in an elevated position.
Tricia in Appleton, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, I have a German Shepherd mix. He's a great dog, and you guys were talking about nail trimming and stuff like that, and I do my own nail trimming at home, but I can't seem to get him to ever calm down, and it sounds really awful when, like, I try to cut his nails, he gets upset, he starts, like, yelping and making noise, and he's a senior, he's 12, and even when he was a puppy, he was always sensitive about his feet. I tried to desensitize him, but it seems like it just got worse when he got older.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's any, like, herbal supplements or something to calm them down. I don't know what to do.
Yeah, and you know, at this point, a couple of things that I would try. One would be, you know, go back to desensitizing. Just, you know, touching his feet, having the clippers handy. You know, just touching his toe. And this is not a one person job. You're often looking at somebody, you know, interacting with the dog while somebody else is handling their feet and doing things. So it would be difficult for you to do on your own. Some folks have had really good success with using a grinder to grind the nails rather than using your standard nail trimmer. And so if that might be, again, something to consider trying, I would recommend not going with, there's a product on the market called the Petty Paw, which has a really weak motor. As soon as the nail touches the rotating disc, it stops. What I use at home is something that I've just picked up at one of the you know, home improvement stores, a Dremel tool with a sanding paper disc on the end. And that works really well at just kind of getting those sharp points off. And you can get the nails quite short with them without, you know, risking getting back into the quick. So might be, again, something to try. But again, doing it by yourself may be almost impossible. Medicating a dog, most of the things you're going to find over the counter, herbal products and so on, the dog, if they're really terrified, are just going to override. There may be some prescription drugs that can be used, different sedatives and things. But again, if they're terrified, they may override them. We will often have dogs in that need to have their nails trimmed, and we're looking at using injectable sedation that knocks them out, that we can then, you know, turn around and reverse, so that we can have a good experience, not let the dog, you know, be scared. And they wake up and they don't even know what's happened to them. And that's maybe sound a little bit extreme, but if the nails need to be trimmed, sometimes that's our only alternative.
Mm.
Yeah, he's just been getting so bad lately that I don't want it to get to the point. And I usually have somebody like calm him down, but lately it's just been really, really hard. So maybe
I had a dog that just passed away in November, Bulldozer. He was so bad for his nails. I could not do them at home. It took three people holding him, a Hannibal Lecter muzzle, because he was a bulldog. He couldn't wear a regular muzzle. We had to be very light with our restraint because he would turn blue being a bulldog while somebody trimmed his nails. It was, you know, it took all the forces to be able to get his nails done. You know, and walking outside on the sidewalk helped wear them down a little bit, but there was always that odd nail or two that still needed to be looked into. And again, it was one of those days where I had to buy lunch for my staff members if they had to help me with that. So I feel for you. It's a tough place to be.
Yep. Thanks, Tricia. Jeff and Merrill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 5-year-old English Bulldog, and I have a problem. He has bad allergy problems. I get a discharge from his eyes. I just had him into the vet. The antihistamine is rather expensive, and I was told by somebody that I could possibly try Benadryl. I did ask the vet about it, and he said that I could try it, but I forgot to ask him, how do I go about adjusting the dosage, and is this anything that you would suggest that I try?
Yeah, most dogs with allergies, a couple of the things that you want to be looking into is finding out what your dog's allergic to would be one thing, so that you can actually do some immune therapy, which is now getting easier and easier because we're able to make, instead of allergy shots, sublingual drops that most dogs tolerate very well. And if you've got as an owner, if you're fearful of needles, then you're not having to give your dog injections. Going through a food trial, which would be directed by your veterinarian with usually a hydrolyzed protein diet, making sure that secondary bacterial and yeast infections are kept at bay, frequent bathing. And I know that bathing a bulldog is not the easiest. I'm remodeling my main bathroom right now and are putting in a walk-in shower, which we never had before. Took out a whirlpool tub and all this stuff so I can bathe my dogs in comfort in the shower. But that's what one of the things that really helps. And sometimes just doing things like damp mopping them when they come in from outdoors to get any of the irritating allergens off of their skin, wiping their feet down, their face and so on, is going to help with preventing some of these things. My feeling on using antihistamines as a sole agent for treating dogs with allergies is that they usually don't work. Especially, you know, most dogs, they have more than one allergy-producing chemical in their body. It's not just all histamine. And so using something like Benadryl, which you can get over the counter, may make the dog a little sedated, may help a little bit, but it's not going to cure your dog. Fortunately, though, there's a new drug on the market that just got launched last month by the Bayer Company, and it's called Apoquil. It's a very unique drug for dealing with dogs that are itchy, and it's called a JAK kinase inhibitor. So it actually works on kind of the nerve system. It's not a steroid, virtually like no side effects. And it's just a really nice thing to be able to pull out of our hat of things to do for dogs with allergies. And that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about. How expensive is it? You're probably looking at the average like cost per dog for the first month, is because you have to use it twice a day, is probably going to be about $60, and then it'll drop about half to that, like $25, $30 after that. So for a dog with a chronic problem, I know that's sounds like a lot of money, but just think, if you can stop that itching and so on, you may help prevent some of those secondary infections because he's not going to be traumatizing his skin. So talk to your veterinarian about this new medication that's out there. I just have a few patients on it right now, but our dermatology folks absolutely love it.
And what's the name of it again?
Apoquil, A-P-O-Q-U, I think it's I-L or E-L. So,
okay, Apoquil.
Yep.
Thanks, Jeff, for calling. I appreciate it. Bill from Wausau wondered whether for dogs there are supplements to put in water or maybe treats to give that will help with dog dental health.
That's why I recommended that VOHC.org, because there are lots of products out there, powders and rinses and so on. But, you know, dogs don't swish and hold things in their mouth. Treats, you know, if you can have a dog with significant dental disease and you want to provide them with something that they can chew, it may be painful, or they may decide that I'm just going to swallow it whole so I don't have to have contact with my teeth. So some of these things are meant to help maintain a mouth once the mouth is clean. There's very little that can be done once you've got disease in the mouth besides professional dental care. So, if it's too good to be true, spray this in your dog's mouth and everything's going to get better, it probably is too good to be true. So I, as a professional, only go down that list that the dental pros in the country have come out with to say this is what works. And yes, there are treats on there, things like Greeny Bones. There are diets on there, like Science Diet Oral Care and TD and the Waltham Oral Care. And there's several others on there that work very well. There are some rinses and water additives, but your best bet is a clean mouth followed by brushing, and then maybe using some of these other things that you can maybe add in that's going to help. But there's nothing that's a miracle.
Okay. Janet in Oconomowoc wonders, her daughter's golden retriever has Pseudomonas infection in his ear, several antibiotics over the last 8 months. It clears up until he finishes the meds. Now the vet wants to remove the ear canal for about $3,000.
You know, this is one of these things that is my kind of a pet peeve. It's a golden retriever. This dog probably has allergic dermatitis. If they address that allergic dermatitis, the underlying problem why this dog is getting chronic ear infections, we may have been able to prevent this. And so even though treating allergies may be expensive, it's a lot less expensive than removing an ear canal. And if the doctor is recommending this, it probably is one of these ear canals that what we call an end-stage ear. It's so scarred up and so swollen, you just can't get medication in effectively. You may have a middle ear infection, and it's actually a last resort type of thing. Before that's done, get a good evaluation by a veterinary dermatologist. They may be able to come up with some things that may be able to help this dog to shrink that tissue down so that it can be treated effectively, and then look into getting down to the underlying problem, usually allergic skin disease.
Oh, that's
poor dog.
Yeah, that is really, really.
And Pseudomonas is one of those nasty, nasty bugs that's resistant to so many antibiotics.
Oh. Well, I hate to quit on that note, but we're out of time.
Yeah, we are, but I'll be back next month, Tuesday.
Second Tuesday in March. That's March 11th, all as right. a matter of fact. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back on March 11th, and we will go through this process with her again. She's a professor of veterinary medicine, of course, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Tomorrow at 11, we'll learn about the importance of Wisconsin's wetlands to start with. And then at 11:45, we'll talk with the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion. Wonder what that's all about? Well, you'll find out tomorrow. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.